Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin and devote the first hour to the what is considered by many to be an impending attack on Iran by the United States Air Force and the United States Navy aircraft carriers. And we'll be talking to one of the world's most authoritative and respected military historians, Dr. Martin Van Creewald, who is a professor of history at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And he specializes in the history of war, politics, social and cultural aspects of war. He also concerns himself with women's history and feminism. He was born in the Netherlands, lived in Israel since 1950, and is Israel's most prominent military historian. He holds a degree from the London School of Economics and the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And he's written a number of books on history of military and strategy, including The Art of War and Military Thought, Men, Women, and War, Defending Israel, A Controversial Plan for Peace, The Rise and Decline of the State, and his latest, The Changing Face of War, Lessons of Combat from the Marne to Iraq, will be published in February of this year. Dr. Van Creewald made headlines when he wrote an op-ed piece about a year ago, saying, quoting here, "For misleading the American people and launching the most foolish war since Emperor Augustus in 9 AD sent his legions into Germany and lost them, Bush deserves to be impeached and, once he has been removed from office, put on trial along with the rest of the president's men. If convicted, they'll have plenty of time to mull over their sins." So we'll be talking to Dr. Van Creewald, who believes that the Iraq war is one of the greatest strategic blunders, but believes also that an attack on Iran would be an even greater strategic blunder, compounding the mess that we already have. And then we'll begin in a moment with Larry Diamond, who is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's a professor of political science and sociology at Stanford University. He's also been the co-editor of the widely respected Journal of Democracy since its founding in 1990. From January to April of 2004, he served as a senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad. He is the author of Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq. And he's also the co-author of a recent opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times this last week entitled "Congress Must Stop the Attack on Iran." And of course, Larry Diamond is with a very conservative think tank, the Hoover Institution, and he also was personally asked to go to Iraq by Condoleezza Rice. His book about the catastrophic failure to win the peace and rebuild Iraq after the so-called mission accomplished has not won him too many friends in the administration. But the point, I guess, is that we have a conservative voice joining a lot of conservative military and intelligence people who are all sounding the alarm. So where there is smoke, there might well be fire. I'm speaking with Larry Diamond, who's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and professor of political science and sociology at Stanford University. He has been the co-editor of the widely respected Journal of Democracy since its founding in 1990. From January to April 2004, he served as a senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad. He's the author of Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort in Bringing Democracy to Iraq. And he's the co-author of a recent op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times entitled "Congress Must Stop an Attack on Iran." And your voice has been added to a number of senior military people. There were three former commandant of the Marine Corps, head of CENTCOM, General Guard, General Hoare, and Admiral Shanahan went on British television last week on the BBC, urging the British public to lobby Tony Blair to use his influence on George W. Bush to prevent an attack on Iran. So one gets the feeling that prior to 9/11, there was what they call chatter in the ether. There's a lot of chatter out there that there's going to be something that's going to happen vis-a-vis Iran, and people like yourself seem to be extremely alarmed.
Yes, we are alarmed. I mean, how do you justify, just to give you one example, sending a naval admiral who's specialty is in air and sea war, to be the new commander of our central command when we're in the middle of the biggest land war in a generation in the Middle East. How do you justify that unless there's some other plan in the works? There are so many signals, the dispatch of a second aircraft carrier battle group, the chatter from the Bush administration itself and its warnings that this is being seriously considered at a minimum. And I think it would be a colossal mistake to pile one colossal strategic blunder on another when we're so militarily overstretched and our standing in the world has plunged to such an extremely low level because of our unilateral military actions, I think would really be true folly.
And what about the consequences for our Army and Marines in Iraq itself? There's a rumor that Abizaid was not so much, he didn't so much resign as he was fired because he didn't want to sign on to these plans, because he understands how vulnerable the Marines and the Army are in Iraq and how much the Shia shoe hasn't dropped, if you will. Largely,
right.
We're fighting the Sunni insurgents. The Shia, I think, are keeping their powder dry because we're killing their enemy. But you get the impression that the Iranians perhaps have the ability to turn the Shia on, if you will, or slip loose the dogs of war, to quote Shakespeare.
I think there's no question that while Iran has been causing deadly difficulty for the United States in Iraq by shipping highly effective, specially shaped, improvised explosive devices to be used against American forces, you know, they haven't even begun to unleash the full specter of retaliation and sabotage against the American effort that they could if they wanted to. And it's not only in Iraq where Iranian unconventional warfare against the United States could be unleashed. It would be in a heightened campaign of terrorism throughout the region and the world. But, you know, more to the point is the fact that this isn't even smart if your goal is to contain the Iranian threat, because the best way to contain the Iranian threat is to allow the natural organic forces of disillusionment with the Islamic Republic, frustration and resentment with the incompetence and corruption of the ruling regime, to work their way into new forms of regime evolution and change in a peaceful way internal to the country. And if we unleash a kind of devastating multi-day hundreds of sorties and cruise missiles bombing campaign to try and derail Iran's nuclear program, first of all, it will only set it back probably by some few years at most. Second of all, it will unite the country around the goal of having nuclear weapons in order to defend themselves. And third, it will completely destroy the democratic opposition in Iran and cause people there to rally around the regime reluctantly, but in a nationalist reaction.
And if the U.S. does go ahead and with this bombing, and as I say, there's been talk about it, there's been chatter, there's been a movement of ships, and you mentioned some of the indicators vis-a-vis Admiral Fallon's appointment to CENTCOM. I believe that stealth fighters have been moved to Incirlik and that there are B-2 bombers down in Diego Garcia. And there's a sense, I don't know, let me ask you this, Larry Diamond, is there a feeling, and you know the military, that a lot of the services, you know, like to get in on the action, and the Air Force has largely been out of this war, and so has the Navy?
I don't think that's the right way to put it, that the military is chomping at the bit to get their piece of global warfare here. I think that's very unfair to the services and to the reservations that my guess is a number of military officers probably have about the wisdom of this venture. But we live in a democracy in which there's civilian control of the military and in which the military answers to and implements the orders of their civilian commanders. That is, as it should be. I hope we also live in a democracy where the Congress is able to exercise its oversight and its constraint, and where the President of the United States is not allowed to launch a war of choice without congressional authorization. And I think it's simply urgent right now. I can't underscore enough the time sensitivity of this, that the Congress act to forbid the use of any American funds to attack Iran on its soil without explicit congressional authorization. If the president thinks that this is so important to our national security that we have to act in a preventive way again a second time within 4 years to derail a presumed threat to our national security, let him come to the Congress and the American people and justify it. I don't think he can succeed in doing that.
And the opinion piece that you wrote in the Los Angeles Times this week with Leonard Weiss, Congress must stop an attack on Iran, you further add in terms of your urging the Congress to use their constitutional authority to stop what we're talking about here is, although we don't know for sure, there's certainly there's enough smoke there to sense that could be a fire down the road. If indeed the president doesn't take notice of Congress, you're talking about the impeachment step.
Well, it's not simply taking notice. If the Congress passed a law and it came into effect, either because the president signed it or because his veto was overridden, that forbade the use of funds to attack Iran, and he did it anyway, then he would be violating the law, and it would be a high crime, an impeachable offense. I don't think he'd do it at that point,
right.
But I think it has to be made clear. Legally and constitutionally, the gravity of what he would be doing.
But what bothers you, I detect, Larry Diamond, is that there isn't sufficient alarm in the Congress and backbone, and there certainly doesn't appear to be in the press. Senior people and people like yourself who have been insiders in this very administration that we're talking about are alarmed. I don't understand why the Congress is so supine and why the press are not sounding the alarm.
I think part of it is that that Iraq is going on, and there's frankly so much else going on. You've got the the presidential race heating up. I hate to put it this way in my cynicism about the media, but have you looked at the coverage of the untimely death of Anna Nicole Smith in the last 72 hours?
Well, it's been difficult not to see anything else, you know.
And the media spectacle and frenzy about that. If you go back and look at why the United States didn't focus more attention on the Rwandan genocide as it was going on, you find something really appalling about the mass media in the United States. You know what was dominating the news back then when 700,000 to 1 million people were being hacked to death in genocidal violence in Rwanda?
Probably it was
the O.J. Simpson trial.
Right.
So I think that the media has a role to play here, to make this one of the central topics of American conversation right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Larry Diamond, who along with Leonard Weiss, had a piece in the Los Angeles Times this week, Congress must stop an attack on Iran. Obviously, this is a speculative notion that the United States is about to attack Iran, but there's enough evidence, and there's certainly a chorus of alarm amongst a lot of senior military and intelligence people who suspect this is in the cards, although there have been successive denials from the new Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, and the President and the Vice President. We've already talked about why the press is dropping the ball here. How about the Congress then? What's going to give them some backbone?
I think that they are developing backbone. We see it in at least the House's determination to bring a resolution on the Iraq war expansion to a vote by Friday. But I think part of the problem is that in the House, In both houses, they're focused on the war in Iraq right now and the urgent issue of the troop surge and what is to be done in Iraq at a very crucial turning point in the war. And then you have the additional problem in the Senate that you can't bring anything to a vote unless you can get 60 votes to shut down a filibuster. But nevertheless, I think they need to focus on this and urgently. It's a question of priorities and timing as much as anything. I'm sure there's also the concern as well, well, what if we're wrong and Iran is getting closer to a nuclear weapon, we'll be blamed for it. And that's where the supine element comes in. And that's how we got into this disastrous war in Iraq, that the Congress is so concerned about being blamed for some new national security calamity that they sit by and watch while a war of choice becomes a national security calamity.
But it would seem to me that, just to touch on the political landscape, that the Democrats have been dogged since about 1952 by this notion that they're not the suitable and mature stewards of the United States national security, and that that's been the domain of the Republicans almost exclusively in for the last 30-odd years, 50 years, with a few interregnums in between with Democratic presidents. But they, in many ways, they voted for the war resolution because they didn't want to look soft on terrorism, and an echo of the old Cold War notion of being soft on the communists. So it would seem to me that the Republicans, this administration, has made such a mess of things that the Democrats are actually poised to get rid of that ghost. And I think if you look towards 08, it seems that they may well pick up more House seats, more Senate seats, and the executive branch. So is it possible that the Democrats are saying to themselves in caucus, well, why don't we step back and let this train wreck happen?
No, I don't think so. Not with respect to Iran or Iraq, where you see them mobilizing more and more to try and achieve a different policy. I think the cost would just be too high. I doubt that there are many people in the Congress who would be that cynical. I think the question is more that there's so much going on right now, and this is all, after all, a matter of speculation. There's no hard evidence that the administration is planning to launch an air war against Iran. The administration itself keeps denying it, which I think its denials and assurances on everything related to our role in the world at this point lack much credibility. But nevertheless, you've got a lot of priorities on your legislative agenda, and this is simply a possibility out there at some point in the future. The tendency is to act on the imminent and consider the possible for later down the road. What worries some of us is that the possible could come within a matter of months. And this is why I think it's very important that the Congress, in deliberating on these appropriation bills for the Pentagon, attach a rider to the appropriation bill that no funds can be used to attack the soil of Iran without congressional authorization. And then if President Bush doesn't like that, let him try and veto a Pentagon authorization bill.
And you think that the Republican Congress wouldn't buy the almost predictable administration argument that this is tying the hands of the executive branch in its prerogatives vis-a-vis foreign policy?
I think that most Republicans would resist this measure, but if it's attached to a Pentagon authorization bill, they're not going to have any choice because they'd have to vote against funding the Pentagon in order to stop this. That's what I think gives us the real traction here to stop what would be a disastrous expansion of the war in the Middle East.
And just give us, in closing, Larry Diamond, the best case and the worst case. Martin Van Creewald from Hebrew University in Jerusalem, the military historian, is following you. And just in a pre-interview I did with him, he thinks that the Iraq War's biggest strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus went into Germany in 9 AD. He thinks an attack on Iran would be an even greater blunder, but he also thinks that it could be done. He's saying it shouldn't be done, because for the same reasons that you've stated, which is that we'll condemn the Iranian people to decades of the misrule of the mullahs instead of breaking them away from the mullahs. And that's the testimony that was given recently before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee by a number of former national security advisors, including Zbigniew Brzezinski, who said mm-hmm. that their economy's falling apart. You know, the Saudis can drop right. the price of oil. And you know, let's try and you recall back in the days of Khatami, there was a reform movement. And I think our blunder next door in Iraq, nobody wants to be liberated if Iraq is the example, you know.
All of that is correct. And, you know, I think that there is a significant chance this will happen. There's a significant chance this will be stopped. If it happens, I think it's going to leave the United States much more isolated and resented, even detested around the world, even than it is now. I think that there will be an intense reaction throughout the Islamic world at the United States having gone to war against another Muslim country, even though it may be one whose regime is feared and resented in many parts of the Muslim world. And this will actually transcend the Sunni-Shia divide in the Middle East. And many Sunni Arab populations, I think, will also be outraged against the unilateral exercise of American power in this, quote, preventive, end quote, way, even though some of their regimes might be relieved to have the nuclear threat of Iran derailed for a period of time. And you'd see an immediate and, I think, severe deterioration in the situation in Iraq, and, as you say, a nationalist rallying around a decrepit regime in Iran that would give it a very significant extended lease on life. I'm not sure it would be 30 years, but it would be long enough to very seriously intensify the international security challenges we face.
And I don't know whether you caught the piece by Anna de Bograv, Larry Diamond. That, you know, he's the UPI bureau chief in Washington, formerly Newsweek. He was at a reception in Blair House the other day for the head of protocol, who was George W. Bush's college roommate at Yale. And at this meeting, there was a prominent Iranian-American who collared the president and said, you know, if you drop one bomb in Iran, you will drive the people into the hands of the mullahs for 20 or 30 years. Please don't do it. And the president said, yeah, I hear you. I hear you. And then the Iranian American said, "And well, what about the vice president? Does he hear me?" Mm-hmm. And apparently, the president chuckled and walked away. So I don't know what to make of that. But I just thought I'd.
Well, I think that the two things to be said are: first of all, the president said, "I hear you." He didn't say, "I agree with you." And second of all, the vice president, who I think is pretty clearly an advocate of this military course of action, is not a laughing matter. I think he is as responsible as any single individual for the calamity of our intervention in Iraq, and I see no indication that he's learned a single thing from our failure there. So I think this is really, I'm really quite frightened. I can't remember a time since the Cuban Missile Crisis when I've been more deeply worried about the state of our national security.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Larry Diamond.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Larry Diamond, who's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's the author of Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq, and the co-author of a recent op-ed in the Los Angeles Times entitled Congress Must Stop an Attack on Iran. Let's now go to Jerusalem. I'm speaking with Dr. Martin Van Creewald, who's a professor of history at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He specializes in the history of war, its political, social, and cultural aspects. He also concerns himself with women's history and feminism. Born in the Netherlands, he lived in Israel since 1950 and is Israel's most prominent military historian. He also holds a degree from the London School of Economics and Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's the author of a number of books on war and history, The Art of War, War and Military Thought, Men, Women in Combat, from the Marne to Iraq, to be published on the 27th of February. Dr. Van Creveld, you made headlines a year or so ago when you wrote in an op-ed in the Jewish Forward suggesting that for misleading the American people and launching the most foolish war since Emperor Augustus in 9 BC sent his, actually I think it's 9 AD, sent his legions into Germany and lost them, Bush deserves to be impeached and, once he's been removed from office, put on trial along with the rest of the president's men. If convicted, they'll have plenty of time to mull over their sins. Since then, I think the case against President Bush has gotten worse, has it not?
Yes, unfortunately so. And you know, I sometimes think the only reason why he's not impeached is because in that case you're going to get Cheney, which is even worse.
Well, there's a theory and a rumor in this country that, in effect, the president has outsourced his presidency to his deputy, and that, in many ways, Cheney has been running the show all along.
Exactly. So suppose you impeach Bush for, as you just voted, misleading the American people into, in my opinion, a very foolish war in Iraq. Suppose you do that, and you get Cheney, which is even worse.
Well, then I guess you should revise your piece and suggest that they impeach Cheney.
Yes, some people suggest that the best thing to do would be to ask Cheney to have Bush come over for a hunting party.
Well, tell me, Dr. Van Creveld, from an Israeli point of view, there's a prevailing feeling here that the neoconservatives, in many ways, were connected to the Likud and the Israeli right, and in many ways they launched this war as a way to secure Israel and to remove its threat from Iraq. It would seem, if that was the motive, that it has backfired. My understanding of where we stand now strategically, or where Israel stands now strategically, is that the invasion of Iraq has clearly rewarded and emboldened and strengthened Iran. The Shiite are ethnically cleansing the Sunni from Baghdad and from other Sunni areas, driving him into Al-Anbar province. There's a million refugees in Jordan and perhaps an equal amount in Syria. At the end of the day, it would seem that the Sunni will win, that the Shia will be stuck in Jordan, angry, armed, trained to fight against the best army in the world, armed and funded by the Saudis. Are they likely to turn to the West?
I really don't see how the Sunnis can win, given that they're only about one-third of the country's population, and given that the other side is backed by Iran. The way I foresee the future in Iraq, sooner or later the Americans are going to get out. They'll have to get out before the next elections, or somebody is going to lose very bad. And then we'll see a civil war unleashed in Iraq, which may last for a very, very long time, and bring in foreign intervention, both Saudi and Iranian, and maybe Turkish, maybe Jordanian, maybe Syrian, who knows. There'll be a new 30 years war fought out on Iraqi soil between the various factions and countries in the Arab world.
So, in other words, my analysis, or other people have made it, that the Sunni will be soon defeated and therefore destabilize Jordan and eventually move on Israel. You're suggesting that it'll take 30 years of agony in that neighborhood before Israel is directly threatened on its eastern border?
Well, I don't see that Israel is directly threatened at all. This civil war is taking place hundreds and hundreds of kilometers to the east of us. Mm-hmm. And unless the Jordanian regime comes falling down, I do not see that it is a great threat to Israel. The countries that are really threatened by all of this, I suppose, are the Gulf states, above all, Kuwait.
Well,
they want into the war.
So is it therefore possible that you could argue that the neoconservatives were right, if indeed that was their strategy, to have the Sunni and the Shia fight amongst themselves, and therefore be less of a threat to Israel?
Well, there is no question that Israel has gained from this war, because the country that in the 1980s was presented as the greatest threat to Israel, we were always talking about the so-called Eastern Front, has disappeared from the map and is very unlikely to rise again. But that is not the same as saying that the United States went. It is also true, of course, that Israel did what it could to push the United States into this war. I very well remember Colin Powell visiting Israel back in the summer of 2002, and Sharon, who was at that time Prime Minister, personally telling them, make sure that you go into Iran. But, you know, the United States is a superpower, and we are just a very small Pekingese, saying that we encourage the United States to go into this war and saying that we benefited from it. Most of which, I suppose, and too, is not the same as saying that the United States did it on our account. I think the United States, and those conservatives included, did it because they thought, mistakenly, as it turned out, that it served the Americans' best interests.
So if just going back to your statement about this being the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus went into Germany in 9 AD, and of course eventually the Germans moved down and literally sat outside the gates of Rome until Rome fell. In this case, you're arguing, obviously, that this has been a disaster for the United States. So if you could explain that, having just said that you think that actually Israel is less threatened by the situation in Iraq, and I'd like you to address the fact that by default, America's strategic blunder has rewarded Iran. But just to firstly, if you could address what you think the consequences are for America.
Well, the country that has gained most from this war is clearly Iran. That was foreseeable and foreseen by many people, including myself. There is no question about that. But to return to Augustus, don't forget that the Roman Empire survived for 400 years after the disaster in the Turkish Republic. The United States will survive the war in Iraq. It will have to withdraw its forces. It will have to do something in order to make sure that Kuwait does not fall to the Iranians. It will have to do something to help Jordan, lest there be civil war there, and maybe the House of Hussein will come crashing down. But there is no danger to the United States as a world power, much less so to the United States homeland, except for terrorism. Terrorism exists in any case. So let's not exaggerate. There will be a time of self-examination. There will be a time of recuperation. There will be a time for licking the wound. But the United States will remain as the strongest world power of all by far. There's no question about that.
But Dr. Van Creewell, many people believe that the United States has already lost one war in Iraq, is in the process of losing another war in Afghanistan, and there's a lot of talk and rumors of war that the Bush-Cheney planning to attack Iran, which I think many analysts think would be an even greater catastrophe. So what's your reading on? I mean, everybody says it's crazy to attack Iran, but on the other hand, there are indications that there are plans being made to do so.
Well, it is the job of general staffs and war departments everywhere to make plans. So you cannot fault the Pentagon for that. I really don't know what Bush is going to do, but my impression over the last few weeks has been the same as yours. It seems to me that Bush is going to war against Iran, and that is the reason why he suddenly started to talk about the aid that the Iranians are giving to the Iraqi guerrillas, and so on, and so on. So, yes, I would agree with those who say that this would be a very foolish move. And I'm afraid that, just as Mr. Bush has already carried out one very foolish move, he's going for another one.
But this one, I think, on a scale of foolishness, is almost astronomically disastrous, is it not? Because instead of severing the people who don't like this theocratic government in Iran, we'll be driving the Iranians back into the clutches of the Ayatollahs for the next 20 or 30 years.
I couldn't agree with you more. By the way, the Iranians themselves seem to be aware of the danger, and they are trying to make all kinds of noises to show that they are really not so bad, that there's no real danger from them, and so on and so on. Only today I saw the Iranian negotiator with the International Atomic Energy Agency saying that Iran does not threaten Israel, has never threatened Israel, and so on and so on. So the Iranians are well aware of the danger. They are almost desperately, I would say, trying to avert it. Whether they'll succeed remains to be seen.
But if you, as a military historian and a strategist, isn't it pretty clear, Dr. Van Creewald, that if the United States starts a bombing and naval campaign against Iran, and their assets apparently are being moved into place, the new head of CENTCOM is a Navy aviator, the Air Force in many ways wants to get in on the act, the Navy, and I mean the Army and the Marines who are bogged down in Iraq apparently understand that this will be a catastrophe for our soldiers in Iraq, and they're not happy about it. And many people think that Abizaid being fired or resigning had something to do with him rejecting these plans. Isn't it pretty clear that if the United States starts bombing Iran, the Iranians will unleash the Shia in Iraq, and they would unleash the Shia in the oil-rich part of Saudi Arabia, and that they would send their speedboats into the Gulf to sink everything that they could get, and in general, it would lead to a shutdown of the Persian Gulf and global recession. Obviously, America's trading rivals, Japan, China, and Europe would suffer more, but it would be a global catastrophe, would it not?
It is certainly a gamble, but it need not be a global catastrophe, no more than the first Gulf War was. Imagine a campaign that lasts for about a month, involves very few American losses, is waged exclusively in the air, either from the sea or from the land, by the Air Force, from the Gulf States, and can be called off because it is launched. It is a wedge only in the air at any one moment. Such a campaign may not necessarily eliminate the Iranian nuclear program, but it may set it back by a few years. Such a campaign may not necessarily be disaster for everybody. Sure, the price of oil would rise, but then after the campaign is over, it would come down again, as happened in 91. As to unleashing the Shiites, I'm not sure they're not doing what they can even now. At least that is what President Bush will be saying. The Iranians are even now doing what they can to stir up the Shiites. So why take this into consideration?
Well, I understood that the United States was fighting largely the Sunni insurgents in Iraq, and that the reason that the Shia weren't fighting us was that there's no reason for them to, because we're killing their enemy, the Sunni. But if we pick a fight with the Shia, we'll have double trouble, will we not?
I think no country likes occupiers who stay for long.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have got into trouble with the Iraqis, Chinese, Sunnis, and Shiites, regardless of what you did. Just by staying there, you invite trouble. And this is what has happened.
I see, but what about then Ahmadinejad's threats? And in fact, recently the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, said that the Iranians could unleash, I guess they were talking about asymmetrical warfare. At one point they mentioned 50,000 paradise operations, which is the euphemism for suiciders. So do they not have assets abroad, like Hezbollah and cells and in various amongst the diaspora and in places like.
Again, this reminds me of 1991. You remember at that time there were great fears of Iraqi terrorism all over the world. None of it materialized. I won't say that the Iranians don't have the capability to unleash some terrorism around the world, but in the end there's always a limit to what you can achieve by terrorism. So actually my answer to that would be no. I would say that the war in Iraq is lost. It doesn't matter what you really do. You are going to lose it. It was bound to be lost before you even started. And the sooner you get out, the better, because there's nothing to achieve that. As to the possibility of a airborne attack on Iran, it need not be an unqualified disaster. Hopefully it can be contained, hopefully, because it will be waged only in the air, it can be cut off at any moment. Hopefully it will not lead to very bad consequences for the rest of the world, and maybe some temporary consequences, as happened in 91, but I don't think they necessarily have to be catastrophic.
So, Dr. Van Griewel, could you then explain what seems to be an inconsistency when we were talking earlier about this would, in fact, rather than free the Iranian people from an unpopular government, this would drive them back into the hands of the mullahs and consolidate this government for decades?
There I agree. The Iranians are determined to build nuclear weapons, and they will get them sooner or later. There's no question about that.
So what would be...
That this whole issue has been vastly inflated. Iran is being presented by the United States president as far more dangerous, a far larger threat than it actually is.
So what would be the end game then if the United States conducted a bombing campaign, and I understand that the plans that have been leaked, and obviously you have to be skeptical about the information, but the plans apparently involve taking out their air force, their navy, all their small boats. There's also suggestions of leadership decapitation. So what do you think would happen the day after? Because obviously the United States did not think about the day after when they invaded Iraq. And I imagine they're not really thinking too seriously or intelligently about the day after in Iran. What would your day after an attack on Iran scenario be?
Well, in a way, that is the beauty of it. There might not be a day after, because if this is waged in the air alone, and assuming that the United States can quickly neutralize Iranian resistance in the air, which is, I think, quite reasonable, then you'll be able to call off this campaign almost at any time you want to and say, you know, we've achieved our objectives. So there need not be a day after. Yes, the Iranians will probably increase their support to the Shiites in Iraq, but they're doing that anyhow. Yes, the Iranians may have some terrorism around the world, but again, you know, the limits to what they can do. They may even fire a few missiles at Israel, but so long as those missiles don't carry unconventional warheads, that is not a very dangerous thing either. So, all in all, I think that the Iranian options are limited. There certainly will be confusion, there certainly will be disorder, there certainly will be a temporary spike in the price of oil, but again, I don't think it's going to be the end of the world.
So, what then, I mean, you don't believe that there'll be a reaction in the Islamic world? The so-called street will erupt? Obviously, there's a schism in the Islamic world between Shia and Sunni, and we know that the Saudis are meeting secretly with Israel, and King Abdullah just brokered a meeting between Hamas and Fatah in Mecca. So there is a strategic realignment going on there, and the extent to which the Sunni states in the Gulf are alarmed at the rise of Iran's influence.
They certainly ought to be alarmed.
Right, but what kind of reaction would there be on the street to a flagrant American aggression against us, another state in that neighborhood.
As you know, there is not much love lost between Sunni Saudis and Kuwaitis and Iranian Shiites, nor is there much love lost between Arabs and Persians, or Arabs and Iranians in general. So I think that if there were an American attack on Iran, the reaction in the rest of the Muslim world actually is going to be very muted. It's not going to be much worse, I think, than in 1991.
And what about the Shia in Pakistan? That Pakistan is a very, very vulnerable and unstable country, or barely stable country.
Yes, Pakistan might be more of a problem.
Uh-huh.
Pakistan, of course, is the key to Afghanistan. If Pakistan goes, then you have to leave Afghanistan to its own devices. So Pakistan is a real problem. But the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the rest, I don't think that they are going to react strongly against an American attack on Iran. I also think that an American attack on Iran can be contained, can be limited, and the beautiful thing about it, hopefully, is that it can be thought of any moment you decide to.
Well, but
to do is announce, you know,
right,
objectives have been achieved. Nobody will be able to check that, and then you can stop bombing.
And what would the Iranian government, or what's left of the Iranian government, do the day after? What you know? Are they? They're not going to.
They would probably support the increase their support to the Shiites in Iraq, but they do that anyhow.
Right.
And maybe therefore the right way, the right time to bomb Iran would be after the American withdrawal from Iraq. They would probably try to minimize the damage. They would say, here we have withstood the American bombardment and we're still here. Our nuclear program is still here, blah, 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 and so on and so on. And they would find their position in the country for this tension. That is the great drawback, of course, of the whole idea.
Well, I imagine some people in the audience are saying, well, when you say it would be beautiful, that probably raises the hackles amongst a number of people. And I still see a contradiction here where you're saying it could be a massive strategic blunder, worse than Iraq, at the same time saying that they can actually get away with it. And so I'm confused.
I'm confused too. The more I think about it, the more it seems to me that maybe it could be done. I would start by getting my troops out of Iraq, first of all. There's no point in keeping American forces in Iraq. Once you do that, maybe the time would have come to really teach the Iranians a lesson. And I don't necessarily think, that it would be a great blunder or a great catastrophe for the world.
So I guess to sum up then, you're saying it could be done, but you still don't think it should be done.
I hope it isn't. Actually, I think that the danger from Iran is being greatly exaggerated. I think the world can live without another war.
So what do you think then, just to return to your country, Israel, and its strategic situation? You're saying earlier that you didn't think that the consequences of the Iraq war, or even a war against Iran, are greatly going to impact Israel, that it may end up with a 30-year intra-Islamic Sunni-Shia war that would be a disaster for the region, but Israel would be largely unscathed.
Well, as far as terrorism goes, we have that anyhow. I mean, other countries have to fear terrorism, but we have been coping with terrorism for so long. As to an Iranian nuclear attack on Israel, I don't believe it. I think that Israel has what it takes to defend itself and to deter an attack, and that the people in Iran, in Tehran, know that very well. So if the United States goes into Iran, we may stand to benefit, but I don't think that we are now in any mortal danger from Iran.
And what about then the conventional wisdom is that the recent war in Lebanon against Hezbollah was in fact not a success, that none of the objectives were obtained, their soldiers weren't returned, the Hezbollah wasn't defeated, and in fact Israel suffered a lot of rocket attacks within its own borders, which was a new and dangerous threat. So give me your analysis then of whether or not the war against Hezbollah was a success or a failure, and if the United States does attack Iran, I imagine you could expect Hezbollah to react, or I mean, well, let me, why don't you answer that, because I'm genuinely puzzled.
Sure. I would be the first to agree that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, did not perform well in Lebanon. But war is not a boxing match. You don't judge the outcome by the number of points. You judge it by the will of the two sides to continue. And if you look at it in this way, then with all due caution, it is my impression that Nasrallah and Hezbollah have learned the lesson. They never expected the Israeli reaction to be nearly as strong as the one that they got. Lebanon was almost demolished. Hundreds of thousands of people were turned into refugees just because Hezbollah killed six Israeli soldiers and captured two more. This came to them as a complete surprise and a complete shock. Nasrallah himself has said, we shall rearm, but we shall not hurry to pull the trigger again. I think, in fact, that we have won this war. We have won this war in the sense that we have now had a longer period of peace there, 6 months, than we've had since 1968. In 39 years, we have never had a period of 6 months quiet as we've had since the end of this war. So my own impression is that Israel may have won this war. And if I were Nasrallah, I would think very much about the role played by Syria and especially by Iran in all this. Here you had an Israeli war against Lebanon, which lasted about over a month. And in the entire month, nobody in Tehran lifted a finger to help Hezbollah. If I were Nasrallah, I would be very careful, very careful. I would think many times before I got involved in such a campaign again. If he does get involved in such a campaign again, well, you know, it will not be nice for Israel. It's no fun. But we've shown that we can survive it and even prosper, and we'll do so again.
So, in other words, we all know that Syria is quite happy to have the last Lebanese die fighting Israel.
Syria and Iran too.
In Iran, to an extent, but there's still this belief that Iraq has the ability to essentially use Hezbollah as a surrogate. So if Iran were attacked by the United States, you don't necessarily think that Nasrallah will take orders from Tehran and do their bidding.
Exactly. I don't think that Iran has very good control over Nasrallah. After all, he's a long way away, and there are two countries, Iraq and Syria, between Tehran and Nasrallah. Nasrallah is above all a Lebanese political party, which also has an armed wing. I think Nasrallah will do what he thinks is good for him and his movement, and that may not necessarily include joining Iran in an attack against Israel, given that the last war has demonstrated how little Tehran can and will do to save Hezbollah. So there's no certainty in this type of thing, but I would not be at all surprised if Nasrallah did not join the counter attack. Even if he did join, okay, there will be some damage, there will be some casualties, we will have to mobilize our forces, and so on, and so on, and so on. But, you know, there are limits to what they can do.
Well, Dr. Van Creewald, it's been fascinating talking with you, and I've gotten a perspective, and the audience has a very different from what we've heard from our conventional thinkers here inside the Beltway in Washington and amongst the pundits here in the United States.
Nice talking to you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Dr. Martin Van Creewald, Professor of History at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and one of Israel's most prominent military historians. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Kurt, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, also helped producing today, and I thank the engineer, Tamika Zoghi.